August 8th, 1844, Nauvoo, Illinois. 6 chaotic weeks had gone by since Joseph Smith was killed while in Carthage jail. Brigham Young stood up to address a massive audience. A hush fell over the crowd. Slowly, people realized something was happening. Brigham Young sounded like Joseph Smith. To some, he even looked like Joseph Smith at that moment. They were convinced he was the true successor to Joseph Smith. The end. Draw the curtains.
If you were raised in virtually any Mormon tradition except Community of Christ, this is probably the way you were taught about the transition from Joseph Smith to Brigham Young. I know I was. A relatively simple, painless process with no confusion. For me, it was very smooth. Joseph died and the next natural successor stepped in. By now, hopefully you've realized that it was far from that. If not, take our word for it. There were several other options like we've talked about. We've spent a lot of time talking about this. Let's just go through them again. Samuel Smith until his death. William Marks. James Strang, that old checkerboard himself. Sidney Rigdon, later on, Alpheus Cutler. Maybe even a Lyman White. Stay tuned for that one. For some, the option was going to be none of the above.
Having said that, it is true, however, that the majority of Mormons would end up following Brigham Young. What kind of majority? That's a good question. We don't really know. It does seem safe to say that it was likely less than you were led to believe, LDS Mormons. But why would people follow Brigham, and by extension, the Quorum of the Twelve? And how did they get to a point where that was the best option for them?
I watch me take a drink. There ain't nothing stopping me. I've been damned before. Last time for just one sin. Now you'll see who I'm for. You made me what I am. You filled me with hate.
Hi, this is Lindsay Hanson Park.
And this is Brian Buchanan.
Bringing you the story of Mormonism from the shadow of the everlasting hills, straight out of Zion. This isn't your grandpa's Mormon history.
Well, I have sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
This is the tale of Mormon saints and sinners from our roots until present day. Saddle up.
Gird your loins, lock your hearts, and pay your tithing, because we're bringing you the story of Mormonism in all its paradisiacal glory.
It's the Sunstone History Podcast.
Well, I've sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I've sinned so gravely, Brother Young. That only you can save me, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. But only you can save me, Brother Young.
First, a word from our friends at Signature Books. Examining Brigham Young's legacy requires an understanding of his raw ambition and religious zeal. A formidable leader in both his church and country, Young's abilities coincided with the colonizing zeitgeist of 19th century America. Thus, by 1877, some 400 Mormon settlements spanned the western frontier from Salt Lake City to outposts in Idaho, Nevada, Arizona, Wyoming, and California. As prophet of the LDS Church and governor of the proposed state of Deseret, Young led several campaigns for Utah statehood while defending polygamy and local sovereignty. His skillful and authoritarian leadership led historian Bernard DeVoto to classify him as an American genius, responsible for turning Joseph Smith's vision into the seed of life. Young's diaries and journals reveal a man dedicated to his church, defensive of his spiritual and temporal claims to authority, and determined to create a modern Zion within the Utah desert. Editor George D. Smith's careful organization and annotation of Young's personal writings provide insight into the mind of Mormonism's dynamic church leader and frontier statesman. Brigham Young, colonizer of the American West, Diaries and Office Journals, 1832 to 1871, edited by George D. Smith, published by Signature Books. Get it at Benchmark Books. No, really, get it at Benchmark. Or wherever you get your books.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. That's good enough for me.
To appreciate our moment here, where the Quorum of the Twelve present themselves as the only legitimate successors to Joseph Smith, we probably need a refresher on their nature. The Cliff's Notes on the Apostles. Do the kids know about Cliff's Notes? I bet they don't. I hear they went digital in 2011? I don't know about that part. Alright, remember that in 1835, after a few years of vague references to apostles, a formal group of 12 is created. From the beginning, their place in the universe was a little conflicted. The group of 70s formed at the same time. What was their relationship to them? The first presidency of Joseph Smith and his counselors, how did they relate to them? After a pretty egalitarian beginning, Mormonism had started to stratify.
The first couple years of the apostles were mostly forgettable. Not until 1837 did they get the first taste of power. You may remember from a million episodes ago that two apostles, Heber Kimball, Want Want, and Orson Hyde, were part of the first group of missionaries to the British Isles. While they did have success in terms of converts, this didn't translate into much more power back in the US.
The Missouri period was disastrous for the status of the Quorum of the Twelve. One apostle died, and five were excommunicated, including Quorum President Thomas Marsh, subject of three, count them three, of Joseph Smith's revelations. In this stunningly short space of time, the Quorum was suddenly at half capacity. The effect was probably more palpable in terms of trust rather than numbers, though. Joseph Smith felt betrayed by Judases at every turn, leaving aside their reasons for dissension for now. Though the Quorum had never been given substantial leadership opportunities, especially by comparison to later periods, Smith undoubtedly had to question the value of this second tier of church hierarchy.
Despite this turn of events, the Quorum was gradually replenished by a new round of selections. This time, with the exception of John Page, Smith was incredibly accurate in identifying men who would remain fiercely loyal to him in the cause. Listen to this roster. John Taylor, predictable, Wilford Woodruff, because of course, George A. Smith, Willard Richards, who wouldn't want that guy on your team. These men were Mormonism for the next 60 years. As a result, during the Nauvoo period, the Quorum of 12 increasingly becomes recognized, even publicly, as a powerful group. However, much of this was happening behind the scenes in a swirl of interlocking groups and movements with expanding goals.
As we've talked about, the last 2 years of Joseph Smith's life were a series of new innovations. Masonry, temple rites, and obviously polygamy. Again, with the exception of John Page and somewhat William Smith, the Quorum was right at the heart of all these developments. Taking their cue from new Quorum President Brigham Young, the apostles were all in. They're fully invested. In a single week, we might see them marrying a plural wife, performing a marriage for somebody else, attending multiple meetings of the Anointed Quorum, or the High Council, where Joseph Smith's lofty kingdom was slowly taking shape.
As you zoom out on all of this, it's clear who is not part of the underground Nauvoo. Sidney Rigdon is definitely not. William Marks is there for parts of it, but his heart isn't in it. It's not easy to quantify exactly how much this was obvious to his colleagues before Joseph Smith's death, but like we talked about, it comes out immediately after. Alpheus Cutler is certainly there, but of course, you know he isn't coming forward to be the guy yet. But big but here, remember that so much of this is going on behind closed doors. How does this translate to the general public, much of which is not part of this?
Part of this discussion, honestly, is our fault. Like so many others, we talk a lot about this other Nauvoo, this world of Masons and Anointed Quorums and polygamists. However, right now, remember one of the unofficial mottos of this podcast, Mormons, suck at secrets. I think we have to admit that your average Nauvooian was likely hearing way more about this kind of stuff going on, and maybe even more important, the guest list for this stuff going on. Think about it. You're a store brand Mormon living in Nauvoo, not part of the Anointed Quorum, your daughter's not marrying a church leader, you don't get any of those invitations to the Council of 50 with top secret embossed on the envelope, but you know exactly which people in town are. And that does something to you. If you believe Joseph Smith is the chief architect of the kingdom of God on earth, then all of these subcontractors in the kingdom must be legitimate.
That is a very interesting question. How much of this was happening subconsciously, where the general populace in Nauvoo gradually sees the Brigham and the Hebers as Joseph Smith's most trusted lieutenants? I've thought about that actually a lot too. That's such an interesting idea because early on, Brigham and Heber... Because remember, obviously, there are a lot of people who will very soon reject that idea completely. And what exactly is this other group seeing that is turning them off? The second question is actually easier, I think, because the first, of course, requires one to admit in the depths of their soul that Brigham had some game.
Could you just repeat that last sentence, please?
Brigham had some game.
Could you, for the folks in the back?
Some game for Brigham.
You're welcome, everyone.
Thanks, Brian. Well, that's a theological game, or at least strategic game. That's what we'll call.
You still said Brigham Young had gave
me
a battle.
No, I don't feel like, I feel like, yes, I have some game.
It's recorded. It's in the public memory now. Okay, we're going to level with you. A simple, satisfying answer to why did people choose Brigham Young in the 12 isn't easy. Not that it's much consolation, but Brigham Young's biographers sometimes take a powder on this one too. The modern LDS response is not just that they were the best choice, but that they were the only logical choice. That it was this natural progression, it was obvious to everyone. Hopefully, we have done our job and you are shaking your head right now. Because it wasn't like some no-brainer. The massive fracture that was already hardening in the community is the stark and unyielding reminder of the stakes at hand. So, many religious movements don't survive the transition to a second leader, at least not with any semblance of the former vitality.
Well, if we can't give you satisfying, we can... just like Brigham Young. Am I right, ladies? We can at least walk with you through the events. Think back to our Joseph Smith for President episode. Remember that at the time Smith is killed, virtually all the main players are out of town jumping for the next president of the United States, Joseph Smith. That meant that the unexpected chaos in Nauvoo was even more pronounced. That interim is so fascinating because for just a few weeks, there's a real power vacuum at headquarters. Sidney Rigdon is in Pittsburgh. Brigham and Heber and the Apostles are mostly out of town. This leaves the second tier guys, your Newell Whitneys and your William Claytons and your Reynolds Cahoons, to try and steer the ship. Oh, and of course, Emma, who is mustering all the soft power she can to make sure her family is taken care of. How does this impact women, particularly in terms of the Relief Society? Oh, friends, stay tuned for a blockbuster on that one. We've got something good coming up.
As we've talked about all of this developing, it's not too surprising that the status quo approach had as much effect as it did. When you're facing the unknown, staying the course is a pretty natural response. Now, obviously, as we've also talked about, a juncture like this can be the long-sought-for opportunity to make a radical break. Let me put on my psychologist hat here for a minute. No, of course not. I have exactly zero trenchant insights here as to why segments of Nauvoo society went one way or another. Just the facts, ma'am. Let's do this. What we do know is that as soon as Brigham and company hear about the murders at Carthage, they immediately set a course that does not involve Sidney Rigdon. Rigdon wanted a conference to happen in Pittsburgh, conveniently, you know, where he lives. The Apostles thumb their nose at that one. They convene in the East instead.
The poor guy was burning bark as a little kid to read, and this is where it gets him. Let that be a lesson to you. Now, this is wild, because according to his biographer, Richard Van Wagner, Rigdon initially was just going to stay in Pittsburgh. But, and this is a huge one, he later claimed he heard Joseph Smith's voice telling him he had to go. The next few months might have turned out a lot more anticlimactic. He does, of course, ultimately decide to leave for Nauvoo and arrives on August 3rd, which is a Saturday. That puts him back at HQ before some of the apostles who are still trickling back into town, most importantly, Brigham Young. Sidney rolls in then on Saturday, and the apostles that have made it back, including Willard Richards, want to meet with him the next day, Sunday. Rigdon, however, seems to stall, and when they track him down, he's getting ready to speak to the congregation gathered for a meeting.
Rigdon immediately starts making his case. We unfortunately don't have minutes from this meeting. What we do have is from William Clayton's diary, so, you know, keep in mind his loyalties. According to this, Rigdon uses as his text the scriptural passage, "For my thoughts are not as your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways." It's an interesting tactic. He then tells his audience about a vision he had in Pittsburgh. Key point is this, quote, "There must be a guardian appointed to build the church up to Joseph as he has begun it." What's interesting is that later, during the Utah period, a note about this meeting is created in which Rigdon supposedly told the crowd that he would waltz into Buckingham Palace and lead Queen Victoria out by the nose, and that, quote, "he was the identical man that the ancient prophets had sung about, wrote, and rejoiced over, and that he was sent to do the identical work that had been the theme of all the prophets in every preceding generation." Yeah, that same note quotes Parley Pratt as saying about Rigdon, quote, "I am the identical man the prophets never sung nor wrote a word about." Take that, Sidney Rigdon. This is according to Clayton.
Okay.
Well, actually, we know how that goes. No, this is the note that the manuscript history editors created in Utah. So
that's very passive aggressive. I like it.
Yeah.
It's not above Parley Pratt, though, let's be honest.
No, it definitely isn't.
Two very important things happen that later that day. First, William Marks, remember, he is president of the Nauvoo stake, and he's a very key player in all of this. If you don't remember that, go back to our William Marks episode. He tells everyone there will be a special meeting on Thursday, August 8th. quote, for the purpose of choosing a guardian, meaning president and trustee. At the same time, Willard Richards tells the people that they should all hold tight until the rest of the apostles return. That's not confusing. Rigdon apparently tried to get the meeting to happen on Tuesday, but William Marks pushes back and makes sure it stays on schedule for Thursday.
We keep saying the days because all of this happens within just 1 week. It's crazy. Sometimes you'll hear people talking about how providential it was that this meeting happened on Thursday, but it just so happened that Brigham Young made it to town in time for it. Now, it's true that they really weren't sure enough of when Brigham Young was going to arrive. There was literally no faster way to get news around than what Brigham was doing, riding a horse. However, it is pretty clear that the consensus was just to hang tight until all the apostles got back, whenever that might be. One very interesting hint of things that we're going to stick here because it doesn't really fit anywhere else better. We have some snippets from the records that the apostles, whether it was Willard Richards as acting president or the 12 as a whole as, quote, president, they were signing documents indicating they were already acting in their future role. Okay, back to work now. The way Willard Richards describes the scene at this point, Rigdon is very nonchalant. Oh, do you guys like need anything from me? Because there's like thousands and tens of thousands of people out there. They want to listen to me and I need to get moving, guys. Here's my take. I really honestly don't think Rigdon was that serious of a competitor. He just doesn't seem to have commanded much respect or even blind obedience from people. Even if they had some sort of meeting on the Tuesday like Rigdon wanted, I don't know that things would have turned out much different. If at all.
For his part, William Clayton smelled a rat. At heart, a company man, Clayton was suspicious of Rigdon trying to move up the meeting since everyone else was pretty much settled on waiting for the apostles. Underneath all this, he told Charles Rich, quote, it seems a plot laid for the saints to take advantage of their situation. I mean, not wrong. Meanwhile, Brigham and company were riding hard, often galloping through the night, stopping only to eat and swap for fresh horses. You're getting close. You may recall that had they not spent so much time la-di-da-ing around in the east, touring expensive houses and gawking at the fancy furniture, all this hustle wouldn't have been so necessary.
On Monday morning, all the dudes that are in Nauvoo by that point descend on Sidney Rigdon. They talk about the meeting that's scheduled for Thursday. Rigdon, sensing I think he had to tread carefully since he was totally outnumbered, said he didn't think they needed to choose a guardian, but just, quote, have a prayer meeting, an interchange of thought and feeling, and warm up each other's hearts. Hey guys, can we just, like, hang out and let's talk about how everybody's summer went? We don't need to make decisions. Now, we get another later reminiscent note about this meeting. Again, it's created during the Utah period. According to this account, Sidney is super manic. He's pacing back and forth. He's raving about how everyone is divided. There's elections going on in Nauvoo. Listen to what the account has him saying, quote, everything is in confusion. You can do nothing. You lack a great leader. You want a head. And unless you unite upon that head, you're blown to the four winds. The anti-Mormons will carry the election. A guardian must be appointed.
George A. Smith gets up and sets him straight. Nah, man, we're all together. Nobody is divided. You're just being a silly fearmonger. This is a tough one to parse out. This account is reminiscent and from a time when Rigdon is definitely persona non grata, so they were prone to exaggerate. However, Rigdon was definitely given to being manic, so who knows? What do we know? Well, Dad got home from work. Brigham, Heber, Wilford Woodruff, Orson Pratt, and Lyman White finally arrived in Nauvoo on Tuesday night. The next day, as you might imagine, Brigham calls a meeting and demands that Rigdon explain just what the hell he's up to. What are these visions and revelations you've been talking about, mister?
Sidney takes a soft sell approach. His vision? Well, that's just a continuation of the vision he had with Joseph Smith in 1832. Remember that section 76 in the Doctrine and Covenants. He came back to Nauvoo just to offer himself as a guardian to the church. There's that word again. While Rigdon's sales pitch, on the whole, is barely up to summer sales standards, his approach of presenting himself as a guardian was pretty smart. Look, guys, nobody can replace Joseph Smith. I'm just here to keep the engine warm. He said, quote, this church must be built up to Joseph, and all blessings we receive must come through him. He reminds them he'd been ordained as a spokesman to Joseph. Really, like he mentions this twice. Finally, he declares that, quote, Joseph sustains the same relationship to this church as he ever has always done. No man can be the successor of Joseph. Yeah, keep that idea in a handy place for just a minute here.
Pull curtains on Act 1. Sidney is done speaking. Brigham then gets up. You don't expect eloquence from this guy. You know you're getting blunt. Nothing different here. He tells the audience, quote, "I do not care who leads the church, even though it were Anne Lee." A woman, that's interesting. "But one thing I must know, and that is what God says about it." He expands on this, but in a way that only a certain swath of people will get. He talks about them having, quote, "the keys and the means of obtaining the mind of God." He talks about giving other people the fullness of the priesthood and reminds the people that, quote, "Joseph conferred upon our heads all the keys and powers belonging to the apostleship." What's the conclusion? Quote, "No man or set of men can get between Joseph and the 12 in this world and the world to come."
We should say that even if Brigham didn't have game, he did have a point here, at least. Because over the last couple years of his life, Joseph Smith charted a specific sort of course, one marked by things like polygamy, like anointed quorums, like councils of 50s. And who is the guy, for better or worse, who is most directly at the middle of all of that? Mr. Charm himself, Elder Brigham Young. And that, in a nutshell, is probably the best explanation of Brigham's appeal as successor. And, as we pointed out, Rigdon is at best a bystander to this course Joseph Smith had taken. Pull curtains again, there's Act Two. They vote to have a special conference the following week.
The next day, and now we're on Thursday, August 8th, William Clayton gets up, goes to a meeting with the 12, comes home just as Brigham walks up, telling him, just kidding. They decided to have the meeting that day after all, and he needs to go round up everyone else. Hitch up your britches, folks. This is it. This is the fateful meeting. This is the one you've heard about. There are a lot of watershed moments in Mormon history, points where things could have turned out very differently. This is one of the biggest, if not the granddaddy of them all. It even made it on a scene on Under the Banner of Heaven. Here on August 8, 1844 in Nauvoo, Brigham Young would set the course of the largest branch of Mormonism for the future.
Lindsay said meeting, singular, and I, for one, will not stand for this because there were actually two meetings. One in the morning and one in the afternoon. Everybody is forgiven for this, however. Journals from folks who are around at this time are pretty sparse in detail, or they don't even mention the morning meeting. There is one report of the meeting in which Sidney Rigdon spoke. So why do we have all this lack of detail? Well, you see, that report is in shorthand. If you're thinking, well, this sounds like a case for shorthand ninja Lajean Purcell Carruth, it's a gold star for you. In 2014, she, another friend of the podcast, Rob Jensen, published an article discussing this meeting and giving us a transcript of the Rigdon sermon. And Lajean admits this was a tough one. She said it was way more difficult than any other sermon that scribe Thomas Bullock had captured during this period. Maybe it was the weather? Who knows? The report's a little fragmenty.
The fragmentary report of the sermon has Sidney Rigdon testifying that the kingdom of God had not changed. You can get a sense for the high drama of the times when Sidney told the audience, quote, "I believe that the next bullet that will be shot will reach my heart." Jeez. Okay, well, you weren't in Carthage, though, buddy. You were sat in your bed at home. Remember that Mormons at this point were really not sure what was going to happen. Was the violence over? What was going to happen? Who was getting arrested? The uncertainty was palpable. Rigdon stayed with the playbook in his sermon, telling listeners that he would remain in his calling as spokesman and basically suggested everyone else should do the same. That was a subtle reminder that he was a first presidency counselor and outranked everyone, the Brigham Youngs of the world, for example. But I imagine it read as a little, I don't know, delusional to everybody else that was scared in Nauvoo.
Brigham got up at the end of the meeting, and this will surprise you, he was brief and to the point. He said, "Hey, listen, guys, I never asked anyone to follow me." You will assume there was definitely some characteristic Brother Brigham phrasing in there, and he does not disappoint us, told the congregation that, quote, "he felt much better than a ship rat." That sounds like Brigham. He told the people that the Tuesday meeting next week, that's off. They were to come back that afternoon, and we're going to settle things. Then the key statement. Brigham stated, quote, "the question is asked, who will take Joseph's place?" And you listeners are all thinking, preach, brother. These two have been talking episode after episode about this. Let's do it. Brigham's answer is the part that modern LDS Mormons aren't really familiar with. Young answered his own question. He, meaning Joseph Smith, keeps it himself. He's his own successor. That's the key. At this point, Brigham was arguing essentially the same thing as Rigdon. Nothing has changed. Everything's the same. Joseph Smith is still in charge. The difference is his perspective, however, that the 12 stayed in their role in continuing Joseph Smith's vision of polygamy, temple rites, and all of that. Nothing had changed. Sidney's up there saying, yeah, isn't that exactly what I just said? You've got two dudes, one message, but yet two very different paths forward.
All of this sets up the fateful afternoon meeting. We have two sets of minutes, both from scribe Thomas Bullock, one a rough draft and the other with some workshopping done. It was clear from the outset that this was going to be a meeting to remember. The second set of minutes describes it as, quote, a special meeting called previously by special notice to choose a guardian or presiding three trustees. All the priesthood quorums were gathered together in designated sections. Women were on the left, the rest on the periphery. With several thousand Mormons in attendance, Brigham Young got up and got things moving. He reminded his listeners that this was the first time they found themselves in this position without a prophet at our head. The final version added a very Brigham touch where he basically told everyone to shut up and not complain about the conditions at the meeting. They were doing the best they could.
Brigham didn't wait long to get in his first plug for the apostles. The rough draft minutes mentioned them, but the expanded minutes describe them first as those who, quote, God has called by his finger. Yeah, but then they crossed that out and they changed it to called by the revelations of Jesus Christ. That aside, he made it clear that the apostles were, quote, ordained and anointed to bear off the keys of the kingdom of God in all the world. The language went through a couple of revisions to get to this point, and it's not an accident, because this wording becomes the standard reference to the so-called last charge. Remember, we had John Dinger on to discuss this in connection with William Marks, and the last charge refers to an alleged meeting where Joseph Smith explicitly charges the apostles with perpetuating the kingdom of God. Of course, because you listened carefully to what Dinger had to say, you know, it was a lot more contested and complicated than that. However, this is the last charge rhetoric that Brigham and the apostles will consistently use going forward to bolster their claims.
It's funny you mentioned Dinger, because I was literally just texting him Fundamentalist Gossip and then realizing that I had to read my part. So Dinger, I wasn't trying to be more scandalous on the gossip and withholding. I'm just recording a podcast. Nice to talk to you. So back to Brigham, he makes another interesting point. He tells the audience that they have walked by sight up to the point with Joseph Smith right there in their midst. Now they are called to live by faith. Oddly enough, Brigham warms up his message in a fairly non-blunt way. He tells the crowd that his job, quote, in behalf of the 12 and the people, is to, what would you expect him to say next? What would you say? Take over? Would you assert authority? Excommunicate someone? Punch Sidney Rigdon in the head? He's had enough of that. Send some dude cross lots? What if I told you he said his job was to ask questions? It's okay. I'm pretty sure no one had Brigham use's Socratic method on their bingo card.
His first question to the church is, do you want somebody to, quote, guide and lead you through this world into the kingdom of God? In other words, he asked, do you even want a guardian or prophet? If so, raise your hand. And boom, every hand goes up, right? No. The minutes are clear. There were no votes for that. The minutes can't convey that, apparently, Brigham Young is kind of leading the witness to some degree. The way he is presenting this idea is apparently sarcastic or something along those lines. We do get one clue by looking at the two sets of minutes. The second, more polished version has Brigham asking, do you want a prophet or guardian or spokesman? Remember, who keeps referring to himself as a spokesman? One Sidney Terwilliger Rigdon. Brigham is poisoning the well against the second speaker on the program.
I've got to talk about that strategy for a minute, because as I was thinking of Sidney's approach, it's his earnestness that does him in. He is so convinced that the movement is his. And you know, what I like about Steve Shields' work is he calls it the Joseph Smith Rigdon movement. You know, he sort of asserts and acknowledges that Rigdon was essential in starting the movement. But at this point, what is Sidney Rigdon offering the people? And his confidence at this point is delusional. Like we mentioned, Nauvoo is in great chaos. Sidney's like, let's do nothing but status quo. Brigham Young comes in, doesn't pretend to be Joseph, doesn't pretend to be on equal authority, and yet co-opts a message. It's pretty clever. So what might the people want then? Brigham seems to know. He describes how, as he was coming to the meeting, he could sense in people's faces what they wanted. A shepherd. What a fascinating way to frame his role. Honestly, even if you pull very active believing LDS folks, shepherd is not really a common way to picture Brigham Young, but it's a genius move on his part. Who else is a shepherd? Perhaps Jesus. Listen, guys, I'm not here to take over a rule with an iron fist. I'm here to help you along the way in this pastoral capacity, as is my way. I'm Brigham Young. I'm just a servant of the people. Don't worry, it doesn't last long. The next words out of his mouth, quote, all that want to draw away a party from the church after them, let them do it if they can, but they will not prosper. If any man thinks he has influence among this people to lead away a party, let him try it. Sounds very much like his divorce advice later on. There we go. that's the Brigham Young we recognize. Welcome back, buddy.
All right, look out, Mormons. Brigham's warmed up now. He turns to the organization of the church and thunders, "If the church is organized and you want to know how it is organized, I will tell you. I know your feelings. Do you want me to tell your feelings?" Wow, geez, he's really warmed up now. Sidney here was the counselor to Joseph Smith. Where's Joseph Smith? He's beyond the veil. I guess if Sidney wants to be his counselor, he better join him. Whatever the 19th century equivalent of mic drop was.
Maybe quill falling? Like his quill fell to the ground? Bam.
Sure, whatever.
Telegraph switch off? No, too early.
You're a little early, but that's not important. You're...
Mail horse retirement. That sounds like a baller move.
All right, okay. Getting off track here. Brigham never needed the Mortal Kombat guy to remind him to finish him. If anything, his special gold cartridge had an announcer that would be like, "Oh, hey, can you take it easy on him, guy?" Brigham told the crowd, "Listen, Sidney came 1,600 miles to tell you what he plans to do. Quote, if the people want President Rigdon to lead them, they may have him." Now, back to his central argument. Again, he reminded the gathered thousands, quote, the Quorum of the Twelve have the keys of the kingdom of God in all the world. Then, just as a nod to the scoreboard, quote, here is Brigham. Have his knees ever faltered? Heber, all the rest of the apostles, all of them totally faithful. I have to think, though, for just a split second, he considered saying something like, we'll accept everyone but Orson Pratt because he totally sucks. But surprisingly, he refrained.
That comes later in many, many different forms.
He'll get back for it.
So just to recap here, Brigham and the apostles, all faithful, loyal dudes that have the keys of the kingdom. Brigham declared that they stand next to Joseph and, of course, compares himself to a shepherd like Jesus. This, of course, is wildly different than Sidney, who had to die to continue being a counselor to Joseph Smith. It's so interesting. I see Sidney like up there looking to the heavens, talking to God, and Brigham's looking and reading the crowd. That's the mood. Modern LDS people, please listen so, so carefully here. Brigham Young's pitch was definitely not as cut and dried as you think it was, as we were told it was. Also, please engrave the next sentence out of his mouth into your memory until we get to December of 1847. Brigham proclaimed, very out loud to thousands of people, quote, you cannot fill the office of a prophet, seer, and revelator. God must do this. I promise you, if you remember this phrase, it will be worth your while.
Brigham once again told the crowd they were welcome to whatever leader they wanted. He said, quote, take them, and we will go our way to build up the kingdom in all the world. He, not so subtly, reminded them that he knew who, quote, Joseph's friends were. P.S. It's not Sidney Rigdon. Brigham knew who had the keys of the kingdom. P.P.S. It's not Sidney Rigdon. If they wanted to hurry up and put somebody at the head, well, that would just destroy everything. The saints would be scattered to the four winds. The priesthood would be severed. Why? Well, we don't really have time for why. Brigham's presentation was very effective. It was very bold. It was very dramatic. It was not, however, necessarily always logical in that he presented evidence that led nicely and neatly to the natural logical conclusion.
He really has a way with making people feel like they have a choice, but absolutely not giving them a choice. Like, you can vote for Sidney if you're a loser.
And you want to blow up everything.
Sure, if you want a guy like that who's clearly ridiculous, I'm not going to stop you. Nicely done. But
it's weird because it's like passive, bold, aggressive. Like,
yeah, that's kind of his style. Passive, bold, aggressive, passive. Aggressive.
Very loud. It's a weird dynamic.
But also wildly humble. But also, I am Jesus Christ himself. Like, nicely done. Honestly, I gotta say, though, after hearing the pitches, I'm with Brigham on this. I hate to say it. Maybe that's why I'm a Brighamite, but he just has a more compelling pitch. I wouldn't follow Sidney at that point, would you?
No. Not many did.
Sidney's solution is, I'm going to get shot in the heart next. Well, we don't want to do that again. No, thank you.
I want the Lion of the Lord. Thank
Willard
you.
Richards is sitting there with his pistol going, dang.
I shot Joseph Smith. I'll do Rigdon too.
Okay, so the force of Brigham's message was mostly delivered. He asked, do you want a patriarch? Cool. Here's William. Or, hint, hint, Uncle John. P.S. Choose door number two. Do you want a trustee and trust? Cool, cool. We'll set Bishop Step up to the plate. That way the apostles can go back to carrying the gospel to the world instead of being the chief cook and bottle washer. Do you want the church properly organized? Well, old Sidney here keeps yelling that he's the spokesman. Just to review, you can only be the spokesman by being dead and with Joseph Smith. So do you want a proper church or do you want to screw everything up? Those are pretty much the options that Brigham presents. You can choose the guy if you're stupid.
And you want to screw everything up. It's the way he presents it. I have to think, like, honestly, people had to have been laughing at some of it, because, like, I think we don't give Brigham enough credit for being snarky. Because
they loved his snark. I love his snark, and I hate his snark. I'm so confused by it all.
If he could be just less racist about it and less misogynistic about it at times, it would be a little more endearing.
That's the thing. You compare his misogyny with Sidney Rigdon's. I don't know. It's sixes. They all mete out their violence in different ways.
Brigham was just louder about it.
The pain inside don't let me sleep. I bit the hand from which I feed. Guilt inside gonna make me bleed.
So, never want to pass up beating a perfectly good dead horse. Brigham said again, listen, my dudes, if you want Sidney or, new option, William Law, totally fine. Quote, you are welcome to them. Again, like, I have to think he would get laughs every time he said that. Here's the deal. He told them, quote, in the name of the Lord, no man can put another between the 12 and the prophet Joseph. Why, you might be asking, quote, because Joseph was their file leader. That's an interesting term. It's been used so much throughout LDS history. Not so much right now, but earlier generations definitely. But I would guess it got used so much, most people forgot it had military origins. So, you know, onward Mormon soldiers and all that, I guess.
Brigham stressed that his message didn't lessen Sidney Rigdon. Oh no, but I'm listening to these last words directed to the spokesman himself, quote, let him be careful what he does, lest that thread which binds us together is cut asunder. Well, that's not at all ominous. Next up, scoring a perfect 10 on the irony scale was, oh, Amasa Lyman. Apparently, as long as he didn't mention Jesus or the worthless atonement, he was allowed to pitch Brigham and the 12 to the crowd. He was fairly brief. Not much to see.
Sidney was actually next on the agenda, but he taps out and he says, you know what? W.W. Phelps can talk for me, aka the best sermon the endowment ever had.
It really was a style thing, right? Like, both W. Phelps and Rigdon liked the flair and the high vocabulary and the drama, and Amasa and Brigham were like, let's go play poker after.
Yeah, they would read books. Brigham would tell people what to do. Those were the differences there. And in choosing Phelps, you kind of guess that by this point, Rigdon could see how the scoreboard is shaping up. And Phelps definitely didn't do Sidney any favors. He made a point of repeating that Sidney only got a part of the developing temple rituals. And you remember we talked about Phelps' eulogy for Joseph Smith and how bonkers it was? This sermon was right up there with it. In case you're starting to think that Judge William Wines was going to make some brief, cogent argument, he would quickly prove you wrong.
Nothing stirs up the crowd like a good visitation. He told the saints that Joseph had appeared to him 2 days after his burial. He was in his house and, as one does, told Phelps to have the drivers drive on. Wait, Brother Joseph is the house on wheels? Why, of course it is. So they drove the house around for a while. You are correct in thinking that Conan totally stole this idea for driving the desk around a bit. Then Phelps just woke up from his dream and there it is. Joseph Smith in a house on wheels.
It seems like a 4-year-old. They're like, what if the house had wheels?
Maybe he was a visionary man and saw a Tesla. Who knows? Remember, Phelps was a few months shy of his 53rd birthday, but he totally sounds like he was 93. So rambly. He should have performed the snake. That's what everyone wants from Phelps at this point.
I have to think that at least a few people in the audience saw that he was wrapping up and thought, the hell did the house on wheels have to do with anything? He didn't even try to, like, pull some metaphorical meaning out of it. He was just like, we drove the house around. And then I woke up.
I thought it was an interesting choice to pick Phelps for Rigdon because Phelps ends up being loyal for Brigham. Like, he, right? Am I wrong about that?
It's because Rigdon picks him. Like, if Brigham had picked him, that would have been very clear. It's like, yeah, you screwed up in the past, bud. This is your chance to be loyal again.
That's right. I forget Phelps has been excommunicated a bunch of times.
It's on, like, his A3 reinstatement at this point or something. But yeah, Rigdon chooses him. So it was an odd choice. Not a good choice. Phelps then warned everyone to stay away from those law brothers, naturally, and reminded the Morums to follow the 12. However, I will say for Phelps, his final line was actually pretty good. Quote, I want you all to recollect that Joseph and Hiram have only been removed from the earth, and they now counsel and converse with the gods beyond the reach of powder and ball. Yep, there's that idea of mingling with gods. Sorry, praise to the man truthers, but Eliza Arsenault didn't write it. Phelps did. Then Parley P. Pratt got up and pulled a Phelps, going off about crooked merchants and crappy, sucky lawyers. Really, he never even got close to any kind of point. Then Brigham stood back up. It was time for the main event.
Put away all the chairs in the gym. Make sure all the assignments are made for FHE because we have arrived at our destination. Brigham introduces the momentous vote like this, quote, "If Brother Rigdon is the person you want to lead you, vote for him. But not unless you intend to follow him and support him as you did Joseph. Do not say so without you mean to take his counsel hereafter. And I would say the same for the 12. Don't make a covenant to support them unless you intend to abide by their counsel." In other words, support him if you want to follow the crazy.
Want to screw everything up.
We all know he had a brain injury and he hasn't been the same since.
Seems like he lives in, I don't know, Pittsburgh? I don't think that's Nauvoo.
He then launches into a medley of all the greatest hits, mentions the business that did lay on the shoulders of Joseph. Remember, that's shorthand for the last charge. He says, "The 12 have the power now. We want to build the temple so as to get out our endowment. We have all the signs and tokens."
Apparently, Brigham was going to ask first who wants Sidney Rigdon, but Rigdon taps him on the shoulder and is like, "Nah, do you guys first."
Wait, I just really love that Rigdon at this point is like, "You know what, Brigham makes a lot of sense. Maybe I'm not the guy. Am I the guy? You guys can decide. I don't know.
I'm going to vote for you guys." So he says, "Is it your only desire to sustain the 12 as the first presidency of this people?" And an interesting note, he told the listeners, specifically including women, that if they did choose the 12, quote, "You are now the sole controllers of it. It's y'all's church now, it's not Brigham's." Except it wasn't, but, you know, details.
That is the least prophetic thing Sidney's ever done. Like, "Hey, women, if you're voting for Brigham, you're in charge now."
Not so much. Sounds good. Not really how it's going to work. You know the drill, Mormons. All those in favor by the uplifted hand. Minutes note that every hand went up. Then, just so everyone was clear, anyone who doesn't want the 12, no hands. Now, given what we know happens from this point on, you kind of have to assume that this was a unanimous vote in the same way that the manifesto was a unanimous vote in 1890.
Except for Joseph Smith and in his house on wheels, he's waving from the window.
"Guys, I vote for you. Vroom, vroom, vroom."
Yeah, it's like when we vote in LDS church, we all raise our hands. I remember like voting in someone else's ward. My mom's like, "You can't do that. You don't know those people." Congrats. Now that you've all accepted Brigham Young as your new Joseph Smith in your heart, we can go on a fun tangent, one that incorporates one of the most beloved mythic events in all of LDS Mormonism. Brian, what's your favorite mantle? The great number 7 himself, Mickey? The one over the fireplace? Which mantle do you vote for?
You know I gotta vote for the one that falls over Brigham, or didn't. Your mileage might vary on that one.
This is, of course, the moment when Brigham Young took on the mantle of Joseph Smith. We've all heard it. The mantle rested upon him. Now, the idea itself comes from the Bible because, of course, it does. Think back to 9th grade seminary when you learned about Elijah and his protege, Elisha.
Not that those two names were confusing and trying to remember they're two different people.
I still can't remember. At the beginning of the story, Elijah puts his mantle on Elisha. The whole thing sounds more exotic and mysterious than it should. And there is a reason. LDS Mormons insist on using the crappy King James translation, sorry Mormons, which permanently puts so much of our discourse back into 1611. Mantle is just a coat. Elijah gave his members-only jacket to Elisha. Then the key point at the end of the arc, Elijah is taken up into heaven, and as he's peacing out, he gives his members-only jacket one last time to Elisha. Boom. The mantle fell on Elisha, coat as a symbol for authority.
Mormons really get on board with this metaphor. It goes all the way from pretty metaphorical all the way up to apocalyptically intense. On the low end, just a couple months after this August meeting, William Clayton wrote to Wilford Woodruff and told him, quote, "If you was here, you would see the mantle of the prophet on Brother Brigham very plain." Okay, there's nothing super exotic there. It's just the changing of the guard. Everything's in order. Nothing to worry about. However, over time, this event quickly takes on some very unmetaphorical elements. Some people said that he kind of looked like Joseph Smith. Some said he became the same height as Joseph Smith. Some will take the shapeshifter route and say his face actually changed to look like Joseph Smith. He used Joseph Smith's characteristic hand gestures. But my personal favorite? If you think back to the Ohio period, remember the story where Joseph Smith gets dragged out of his house at night, also Sidney Rigdon, they tar and feather him. Well, apparently, they tried to shove a bottle of something, acid, in his mouth. It chips one of his teeth. This, again apparently, causes him to speak with a bit of a lisp or a whistle for the rest of his life. So for all the ladies out there, you're getting all thirsty about this hot new Joseph Smith pick. Just think about him whistling every time he speaks, kind of like Joe Bluth. That'll hose down your thoughts real quick. Like,
if you want to choose Sidney Rigdon, that's up to you. Just for the record, the Whistling Brigham story comes from Benjamin F. Johnson, who, remember, this is the ancestor of all the LeBaron brothers, so do what you will with that. He's also the one that says that John D. Lee lived out his days, the Lee's Ferry, yada yada. The mantle idea becomes one of those swing the pendulum back kind of discussions, like smashing all the good china for the Kirtland Temple, like the seagulls coming and chomping all the crickets. One of those. Just like all the other stories, there's a kernel in the middle here. For all these Mormons who were truly feeling lost without their beloved Joseph Smith, they desperately wanted a sign, and not a sign on wheels. Phelps. Guess what? When you have a community in high-stress situations who already have a mental framework for God providing signs, people, sit down for this, they interpret things as signs from God. Did Brigham's no-game face actually morph into Joseph's much-game face? I'm gonna vote no. The two don't look anything alike. Did Brigham try to intentionally mimic Joseph Smith? I mean, that's an interesting idea. Who knows? That seems more like Sidney Rigdon's game, who really thought he was on par with him. Did a lot of Mormons sitting in the giant audience that day feel like they knew beyond every fiber of their shadow who this guy was? Absolutely. But did they all feel like that? No, sir, they did not. And over the next 5 years, a whole lot more of them would not feel like that. We've already talked about some of that, but there's a lot more to come. Maybe down along the Pedernales in Texas, where everything, including Lyman White's dreams, is bigger.
Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old-fashioned morphine. Give me that old fashion morphine, that's good enough for me. It was good enough for Isabel.
Did you forget about me, Mr. Duplicity? I hate to bug you in the middle of dinner, but it's time for the Books of Mormons Report, brought to you by Benchmark Books. At least, it would be the Books of Mormons Report if we had a book on the succession crisis, because guess what? We don't. Did you hear that, kids? Somebody really needs to address this glaring lack. So therefore, it's the Articles of Mormons Report. First, another plug for Mike Quinn's BYU Studies article, The Mormon Succession Crisis of 1844. Fun fact, Mike was 30 when he submitted this article. When it finally gets published 2 years later, he wrote in his journal, quote, "I have literally prayed that article into print and feel such relief in seeing it." We do too, Mike. Thanks for it. And we mentioned the article by LeJean and Rob Jensen, also in BYU Studies, entitled Sidney Rigdon's Plea to the Saints. Gives you a good summary of the meetings and, like we said, a transcript of that previously unavailable sermon. Finally, Ron Walker's 6 Days in August, Brigham Young and the Succession Crisis of 1844, which is a chapter from the book A Firm Foundation. It's a good summary of what went down. Now, because it was before the LeJean and Rob article, it does screw up that part, but otherwise it's good. As always, you can get this stuff and everything else you need in the Mormon universe from Benchmark Books. Visit Benchmark in Salt Lake City or at benchmarkbooks.com.
Won't you send destroying Jainites, Brother Young? Spill my blood upon the earth, oh Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I beg you, spill my blood, oh Brother Young. And let it smoke ascend to heaven, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. And let my breast be cut asunder, Brother Young. As an offering for my sins, a smoking incense, Brother Young. A blood atoning for my sinning, Brother Young. Cause I sinned so gravely, Brother Brigham, Brother Young. I have sinned so gravely, Brother Young.
The song you heard today is called Brother Brigham, Brother Young by artist Corb Lund. Check out his music at corblund.com and consider giving a donation to sunstone.org to support this podcast.